Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Heidi Moore of The Guardian, in for Brian Lehrer. One thing we know, New York is a competitive city. People here compete for jobs, for partners, for money, even for pastries. Just witness the long lines in Soho over the summer for the squishy dessert known as the cronut. It feels like there's never enough to go around. It turns out there's a new science of what believing that does to us. What happens to our lives and our brains when we have to make do with a lot less than what we need? Joining me is Eldar Shafir, a psychology professor at Princeton, who co-wrote the new book, Scarcity: Why Having Too Little Means So Much. Eldar, thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here, Heidi.
So we know that scarcity means not having enough. That actually turns out to be a pretty big problem in terms of the way our brains work, right? Why?
Well, you know, our brains have a limited capacity to attend and juggle many things at once. And when we don't have enough, a significant portion of our brain dedicates itself to worrying and juggling the resource we don't have enough of, leaving less for other things we need to worry about.
Right. And you say in the book that you and your co-author had to piece together all the studies of scarcity, that it hasn't really been studied before. What surprised you the most when you started digging?
I think the most surprising outcome of Sandel and my work on the book was sort of figuring out and realizing that we took two very simple pieces. A lot of work that's been done and is well known about the cognitive limitations that we carry around with us, you know, behind the eyes and between the ears, and the problems that arise when people are poor or rushed. And we sort of put two and two together and realized that the cognitive limitations that arise when you're poor and when you're rushed have an enormous impact on your ability to perform and to attend to things that need attending.
Right. From reading the book, it sounds like having not enough money, having not enough time becomes a kind of obsession. It takes up all your thoughts so that you can't do other things, right?
Right. So it happens essentially automatically. Things become top of mind. When you're hungry, you're very attuned to anything having to do with foods. Even if you mean to think about other things, it's very hard to do. When you're poor, something similar happens. An enormous amount of your mental bandwidth is dedicated to just figuring out how to manage your very limited budget. When you're dieting, you spend a lot of time on calorie counts at the detriment of other abilities, et cetera.
Right. So I'm going to open this up to listeners. We're talking with Princeton professor Eldar Shafir about scarcity, the lack of money, the lack of time, and its effect on how we think. How do you respond to not having enough? Call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Professor Shafir, people may think of scarcity when it comes to, say, money, financial scarcity, but you also point out other kinds, like not having enough time, which you cop to in the book as an author, and in a larger context, the economy not providing enough jobs. How do all of those relate to each other?
Well, the one thing that they have in common is that when you don't have enough of something and it weighs on you, you devote an enormous amount of mental energy to it. Now, you do very well dealing with the thing you're preoccupied with. The poor, on a moment-to-moment basis, juggle their finances quite well. They use their dollar much more effectively and carefully and well than the rich. But they basically focus a lot of their bandwidth on managing this moment-to-moment difficulty and have less mind left to attend to many other things that might matter in their lives.
Right. And a lot of their energy, you say, is spent just catching up, not just, you know, working to get ahead, but catching up with how far they're already behind, right?
Exactly. There's a sort of a logic of a trap happening here, because when you're devoting all your energy to moment-to-moment issues you need to deal with and neglect other things on the side, things you're not attending to at the moment, some of that comes at a very high cost. You might take a very high interest loan to solve a current problem, not attending enough to the impact in the future. And actions of this sort, where you neglect things on the periphery, often yield a more difficult tomorrow than today was, thus leading you into a trap that makes things even worse.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things you say in the book is this: the busier you are, the greater the need to say no. The more indebted you are, the greater the need not to buy. Easy to say, sensible to accept, but so hard to do. Why do we feel so badly at managing that time and money, even when we know that we're behind, you know, behind the eight ball cognitively?
Well, you know, controlling these things is tough. Sometimes it looks almost rude. So, you know, one of the issues that come up, one of the advice that we give in the book is to manage your time better. It turns out if you have back-to-back meetings throughout the day without a moment to spare, you know, you're packed too tightly. If anything goes wrong, if one meeting is delayed, you're delayed throughout the day. You need to start leaving things for tomorrow. You're boring for tomorrow. Things get worse. A very nice thing to do is to leave moments of slack throughout the day, to plan moments where you can catch up, regroup, recollect your bandwidth, and start again. Leaving these moments open is not easy. If I decide not to have any meetings between 11 and 12 in the middle of the day, and you want to meet with me, it's kind of rude to say, look, I'm not meeting now, I'm being on my own. It almost sounds wrong. So the kind of thing you might want to do, a trick you might want to do to manage your time better, is to basically make an appointment with yourself. Say, I'm sorry, I have a meeting at 11. Nobody needs to know it's with yourself. It's just a meeting at 11, and now you have a moment to sit in your office, recollect, compose your bandwidth again, and start renewed.
Yeah, we have a caller, Uli from Midtown, who has her own strategy for dealing with scarcity. Uli, how do you do it?
Well, basically, I take into consideration what's going on at the moment. And, the moment is relative. You know, the present is relative. The present can be described as present day, present year. But, you know, ultimately, the present is very fleeting. And for me, it's very important to, be happy with or try to be mindful of what's going on now and try to be content with what's going on now in the moment. And ultimately, I find that scarcity is a very it's a very relative term. You know, it's like, yes, people have wealth and some people don't. But I've personally come into situations where I've had very little of food, and I've been homeless. And in college, I was homeless, and I find that it's helped me to sort of be happy with what I have now, and practice mindfulness even on the train. You know, even on my walks when I walk my dog, just be happy in the moment and not really be so obsessed with what I have or don't have.
Professor, what do you think? Does that work?
Well, Uli makes an important point. Mindfulness is a very useful strategy to use in moments you need to recollect where you are and where you want to dedicate your thinking. He raises an important issue that's worth keeping in mind. You know, scarcity comes in different forms, and they share a lot of the psychology in common, but they also are different in important ways. When you are very rushed for time, to a large extent for many of us who feel very rushed, this is a discretionary step. I mean, we could be less rushed if we chose to do less. It's up to us. When you're very distracted dieting and you have a very important meeting or an exam, you could choose to decide to say, look, I'll diet again next week. This week I'm leaving more bandwidth for more important things. But when you're poor, that option often is not available to you. When you have to worry about rent and meals and taking care of your kids, you don't have the option of saying, I'll stop being poor this week, I'll resume next week. And so in that sense, some forms of scarcity, poverty in particular, capture your mind in a way for which you have much less discretionary control and seem to have to impose a cost that's hard to avoid.
Right. And let's talk about the effect of poverty. One of your findings is that being poor doesn't leave much ability to think about anything except the lack of money, which we've talked about. That casts a different light, though, on our favorite American narrative of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, that Horatio Alger story of coming up from nowhere and suddenly making your fortune. How does that make us think more carefully when we say things in public policy debates, for instance, about, people on food stamps or raising the minimum wage?
That's an important question, Heidi. So, basically it's good to keep in mind when the poor are busy solving their problems, they do very well on the issues they're facing at the moment. Where they pay a severe cost is on everything that's at the periphery for which they have no more mind at the moment. For policymakers, and by the way, a lot of the studies we do have to do with people who are concerned about their finances. They don't have to be living in abject poverty. People who are simply stressed about finishing the month, worried about managing the finances well enough to provide for the families, those are the people who show the effects we're discovering that are covered in the book. And that's true for about 100 to 150 million Americans today. So this is a very, very general phenomenon. For policymakers, what this means is that anything we do to liberate some bandwidth, to make things easier for the person who's feeling strained, would make things a lot better. It's interesting to keep in mind, bandwidth is the single resource we have, which we use for everything we do. It's what we use to remember to take our medications. It's what we use to control our tempers when our kid is annoying. It's what we use to manage our funds. any time policy is able to facilitate a bit part of my management, it gives me more friendly banking, automatic deposits and payments, maybe incomes that come at predictable times as opposed to, you know, occasional windfalls. Anything of that sort that liberates some bandwidth can then be used often in many other domains. I might become a more patient parent. I might adhere to my medications better. And it just opens up a way and a potential to act much more capably in the rest of other aspects in our lives.
Right. And that could explain why a lot of inner city schools don't see a lot of parent involvement, right?
Everything we're finding, and again, it's of course, part of it is not only us. We know well that the poor have a very, very challenging life, everything having to do with less good transportation, less friendly banking, less good advice, etc. All that, in some paradoxical way, as you get into a context that's harder to manage and takes more of your bandwidth, you often also find yourself in contexts that are just more challenging with less help. And yes, the prediction then is you'll be too cognitively loaded to be able to attend to many things that are not burning.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a couple of specific policy prescriptions on how we could help the poor manage better. One thing you note is that when you're poor, often small loans, even of $100, can make a difference, help you buy a school uniform for your kid, for instance. But the way our financial system is, we give out large loans over long periods of time. What kind of lending is more beneficial for the poor, and have we seen that work internationally?
Well, the poor, of course, differ from case to case. There's no simple way to describe the financial strains on the poor. Some of the farmers in India that we describe in some detail in the book, for example, have their income come only once a year. Basically, you harvest your sugar cane and you get all your money, and that's supposed to last you to a large extent till the following harvest a year later. And that's a big challenge, of course, because now you have to smooth your consumption. You have to make sure the income you have lasts for 12 months. When you don't have enough, that's a very big challenge. And what we find among these farmers, for example, is that you basically run out too soon, find yourself poor before harvest and rich after. And in the studies we do, we find that, in fact, before harvest, you show something like 10 IQ points lower in your performance of cognitive tests as opposed to the same person performing those tests 2 months later. So a lot of the insight here is that whatever you can do to liberate this bandwidth and make things better will help. Now, what you do depends, of course, on the particular life the poor live. For many people whose income is low, it's not low every day. It kind of comes and goes. There are periods of relative comfort and followed by periods of difficulty. This issue of basically smoothing through your consumption is a real challenge. And sometimes just small amounts to cover your rent for this month, to cover the broken car so you can go show up at work in time and not be fired, those small steps can make an enormous difference. And when we make those small steps available only, for example, at very high interest, you can see how the trap forms. I need a little bit of money. I borrow at high interest. And guess what? Next month, I owe even more than I did this month, and things derail.
Right. And another interesting aspect you mentioned is this idea that we're looking at right now with all of these protests over minimum wage and fast food jobs. People are striking because they have to live full time on this minimum wage, and it's not enough. They're still under the poverty level. And one of the things that they fear is that they have to juggle work hours. They don't know if 1 week they're working 20 hours or 30 hours or 40 hours, and that takes up their bandwidth. And you suggest that there's actually a governmental solution for that. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, again, it depends on what we're looking and how much government is willing to do. I should say New York, of all places, has been really at the forefront. Mayor Bloomberg and some of the financial empowerment offices engaged in this stuff have had a very sophisticated vision. The idea is not just to educate people, for example, but to provide for friendly contexts from day to day, whether it's help managing transportation, schooling, banking, anything you can do to facilitate a little bit the everyday management of things so as to give me more bandwidth to take care of other things I might be able to do. And yes, I think policymakers in general, it's interesting, even, you know, very well-intentioned policymakers failed to take seriously what bandwidth means. It's kind of interesting. You know, we own our brains, and so we figure we have a good access to understanding what they do. But the fact is we often don't. Our brains do what they do kind of like our liver does. Mm-hmm. And we often don't have a good insight. For example, bandwidth limitations when it comes to driving. We know now that using a cell phone in your car, even without holding it with your hands, has an enormous impact on our ability to drive well. It compares roughly to being legally drunk. But we most of us believe that we can drive and talk on the phone just fine. Same here. The impact on bandwidth is sort of hard to intuit, and policymakers often don't quite see the impact it might have. Think of a poor person who's coming to apply for food stamps. it would never occur to you to charge the person $300 to join this benefits program. I mean, the whole point is they have no money.
Mm-hmm.
But think about giving them a 30-page complicated application form. You know, if they're bandwidth limited, this tax on their bandwidth is sort of, you know, profoundly ill-advised. What you want to do is do all you can to use prior available information, facilitate the form, have somebody help them who's friendly and conscientious. Do all you can to facilitate this entry to the benefits program, to the job training, whatever you can, while minimizing the tax on the bandwidth. And that's a real insight, I think, that, you know, to the extent that policymakers develop and adhere to, might make a substantial difference.
Right. We're talking with Princeton professor Eldar Shafir about scarcity and its effect on how we think. How do you respond to scarcity? Call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And professor, I want to share with you a comment from our website from a caller named Antonio. He says, I was hit pretty hard in the Depression, the Great Recession, but strangely, it's caused me to work harder. I moved to a new industry, got a job, and run a lot more. Also, I'm studying JavaScript after working, after work, whenever I have a moment. But to be honest, he says, all this worrying about recouping everything is exhausting. And you point out that paradox in your book, that sometimes not having enough to work with can make you more creative, can create a product that's more beautiful, or it can run you down and have a destructive effect. How do you explain that paradox?
Well, again, we've all had the experience of, you know, cramming an all-nighter after we've had an assignment in college for 3 months. You know, you know it's there. You plan to do it. You do a little bit here, a little bit there. You go to dinners. You see friends. And all of a sudden, there's 24 hours left, and there's a paper to write. And you sit down, and you work extremely hard, and you might do an extremely good job. In fact, again, the poor often do very well on their moment-to-moment finances. But guess what? When you pull an all-nighter, you're going to be tired the next day. When you pull an all-nighter and work on the paper for 24 hours, you might forget to pay your rent or the parking meter outside, or, you know, the kid needs to be dropped off at school on time. So what you find is that while you're focusing heavily on the thing that matters most, you might perform exceedingly well, better than you did on the same thing throughout the month. But other things suffer, your preparation, your bandwidth available for other concerns diminish, yeah, and you might pay a heavy cost.
Right. But there is an old saying that too much of a good thing is wonderful. Would having more time and money solve our problems, or are we just deluding ourselves?
Well, there's some very beautiful psychology that we discuss briefly in the book. It's of a different sort, and that comes with exactly the opposite, with having lots of slack. You know, we, when we have a lot of money, start using our money less effectively. We waste. We do silly things. We don't pay attention. We forget. We pay fines. We can afford to do it, but we're doing less well. Similarly with other areas, if you're very rich in time, you're just going to be less productive on a day-to-day basis. We often have had the experience when you're on vacation, somehow you find yourself with less time to do basic things like, you know, exercise than you do when you're very busy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the psychology that comes with excessive slack.
Right. So you share an interesting anecdote about just that in the book. It's about wasps and bees and how they build their nests. Can you share that with us?
Well, we take a metaphor from the world of biology where one animal, in this case, the wasp, uses simple mud that comes cheap and easy to use and doesn't have to be done with great effectiveness and efficiency, whereas the bees build hives that are used, you know, that for which they use very expensive material and have to be very economical and efficient. And what you see is that the hives of the bee are a magnificent architectural construction that abides the standards that are hard even for us to abide to in industry today, whereas the wasps are very careless and waste a lot and don't really care and do a much less careful job. And we use that kind of example from the world of animal behavior to then derive some predictions and then test them in human choice.
Right. And that's something we see all the time in New York and in the metropolitan area here. Let's go to our caller, Joe, from Bergen County, New Jersey, who says we probably should feel a little bit more gratitude. Right, Joe?
Yes. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. The purpose of my point is to really contrast and highlight the idea of productivity in the absence of what we perceive to be limited time, whereas in New York metropolitan area, life and work pace, We feel like we need to condense all this into short periods of time. And how productive are we when you look at the European culture, where they take time in the afternoon to rest, and they get, you know, they take longer vacations in the month of August and so forth. But yet, how much less productive are they when they are actually spending more time in a recreational or self time?
Professor, what do you think?
Well, in the book, we discuss some clear cases of this, that productivity that comes with overwork. You know, there's some kind of an inverse curve there. up to some extent, working harder, spending longer, you know, increases your productivity is actually quite impressive. But there comes a point where if you work harder than that, if you're exceeding your capacity to excel, of course, you start paying a price. And workers who spend even more hours at the factory or at their office start producing less than they would if they simply worked fewer hours. So that's, I think that's, the caller is correct in this intuition.
Thank you. That's Professor Eldar Shafir, a psychology professor at Princeton. He co-wrote the new book, Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. And I can tell you it's a pretty fast read. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Heidi. Thank you.